Today, and this is the second in a series that I call Taking Care of Our Own. And in A Whole New World, which is our theme for Holden this summer, what I'm looking at is the fact that the elderly is the fastest growing segment of our population, and what that means for the social policies that we have, our laws, and how we're going to take care of one another as the demographics in our society change. Today, what we'll be talking about specifically is elder abuse and neglect. The most recent congressional study on this subject found that about 5% of the people in our country over the age of 65 are victims of some type of abuse or neglect. And before we really get into this, I guess what I'd like to do is open up the floor to you and get some of your impressions of what type of elder abuse and neglect you're either aware of or you think might constitute part of this problem. Prior to the 1970s, this really wasn't even an issue that was talked about. In 1975, a British doctor coined the term granny bashing because he was starting to see in his practice incidents of physical abuse of elderly patients that he treated. Studies then done in the United States really confirmed that this was also happening in our country. And in the later part of the 70s, it started to receive some national focus. So I'll turn it open to you. What types of things do you think we would constitute elder abuse and neglect? Have you read about or heard about?
Well, I'll just tell about what I know about that's happened in the Portland and Beaverton area where I live. And there's been a lot of press on it, so maybe you've heard about it, but this elderly man, I think he was about 82, had been staying in a rest home, and his daughter was transferred him to another place, and I don't really know why she did this, but she took him. He was found abandoned at a racetrack in Idaho, and she had clipped out his identifying tags in his coat and clothing and put a misinformation note on him, and he had Alzheimer's, and he was in a wheelchair sitting there at the racetrack, and he was very confused, and they somehow were able to trace him down to the rest home, and of course through them knew who his daughter was. And apparently he had another family, a first family, who, because you know, years went by and the man remarried and there was a second group of children, but the children from his first family somehow lost track of him and thought he was dead. And so then it was through the newspaper that the first set of children found him. They were more than happy to rescue him and come and get him, but he was put in under like Children's Service Protection, mm-hmm. something like that.
Adult Protective Services.
Right? Yeah, they were taking care of him until his family came to get him. And right now there's trial going on with the daughter being accused of cashing his Social Security checks illegally. I guess maybe they were to go to the rest home or wherever he was being taken care of. But she apparently was guardian of him anyway. And also for the fact that she abandoned him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really sad for the old fellow, but it's sad for her too, because you have to wonder what kind of what drove her to such a state.
Yeah, that is a really extreme and sad example of domestic elder abuse. I mean, when we think about elder abuse, many times people think about institutional abuse. We hear of nursing homes that are not being well supervised or well run, and examples of extreme patient neglect. But much of the abuse that occurs in domestic situations and occurs at the hands of people who are related to the person who's being abused. So there's definitely this problem in both an institutional and a non-institutional setting. Any other examples that you can think of?
I know of cases where the children are accepting gifts from the parents, and yet the parents don't have enough money either for their basic needs or for the care that they need.
Yeah, and that's a real subtle form.
Like they're trying to buy their love or their attention, and they'll do anything to get it.
You have a situation where through emotional needs and demands, a person's being exploited and being made to feel that if I do not give money to my children or my grandchildren, that they won't love me, they won't take care of me, they won't come to see me. And that's a type of abuse, and in some ways maybe even more insidious, because it's least likely to be reported or least likely to be corrected. You know, the victim of the abuse is not going to complain, and it's a situation that, you know, that could continue on. So financial abuse is certainly exploitation, as well as the physical and emotional.
Along with that emotional, my aunt was in the nursing home, and there are six of us, nieces and nephews, who would always visit her, and she would visit her for at least once a month. She often said that we had to drive to Iowa to see her, and she'd say that I have more visitors than anybody else in the home. People with kids in the same city would never see their kids or their relatives. And, you know, she said that that was very common. I'm sure she was exaggerating, but
she was.
But, and I visit an elderly lady regularly as part of our church's program. And she's 92 and very conscious of what's going on. She's very alert mentally. She's a retired nurse. And several times she has said that she's been given the wrong medication. She knows it. And she's also, she knows what she wants to wear. She knows, and people have been, her skin is very frail, and she's been treated very roughly at times, so that her skin, she's just black and blue. And this is in one of the finest homes in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. So it's scary. I mean, this is a good nursing home.
That's right, and those kinds of reports are replicated all over the country. You know, we hear about those things. I think one of the things that probably was one of the first reasons, I guess, that I became interested in working with the elderly and the rights of the elderly were just my experiences as a child. I'm the oldest of my generation, and so I remember my great-grandparents and taking care of them. I remember visiting my great-grandmother on a weekly basis in a nursing home, and the other people in the home who had no visitors, who would, you know, ask me to come into their rooms. And I remember one woman, I was in the fourth grade, and she said, "I know you're not my granddaughter, but is it all right with you if I call you Darlene just for our visit?" You know, kind of a thing.
Darlene?
Darlene, yes. And so I had a nice visit with her, but, you know, as somebody in the fourth grade, you know, this really struck to the core of my being, to think of this woman that had a granddaughter, somebody who may or may not have been close to my age, but that, you know, whom she never saw. And that is a type of abuse, and that it's neglect. I mean, loneliness, it's not something that we want to see anybody suffer from in our society. And so on the scale of how egregious it is, that may be on a more minimal end of the scale, but still it's certainly a form of neglect.
In our area, I see nursing homes run by a big conglomerate who change people who work there, from the people on, you know, the director on down to the cook, the program director, people that care for the people, quite often. And I think it's so too bad, because these people need continuity. And the continuity seems best in some of the Catholic institutions. Mm-hmm.
So there's somebody new there all the time, and the stranger is always...
Well, it's something, I don't know just why they do it, but it seems like it's done.
Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason for that is probably the pay scale at mm-hmm. a lot of these institutions. My next door neighbor is the administrator of a nursing home in Valparaiso, and it's one of the nicest homes that I've been in. She's done a terrific job of sort of turning it around in the last couple of years, but she's yet to operate in the black. And so she has corporate headquarters, you know, on her constantly about, you know, when are you going to turn a profit? When will you turn a profit? And it's a difficult situation, as we'll talk about later on in this week when we talk about financing long-term care, as the government has increased the requirements on nursing homes in an effort to provide a better quality existence for residents. They've also increased the costs, and for many homes that were already doing a good job, these extra compliance costs on top of the programs that they've already voluntarily put into place have put them in a financial squeeze. And so what they're able to pay their employees, the ability to obtain and keep good health, it becomes a real problem. Well, one other type of abuse or neglect that you know, I'll add to the mix this morning, I think we've done a pretty thorough job, is self-neglect. It's not one that we often think of. When we think about abuse and neglect, we think about it happening at the hands of someone else. I brought this article that I can kind of pass around the room. The photographs are pretty telling. This happened in Michigan City, Indiana, not far from where I live. It says, an elderly couple taken from filthy Michigan City home. Says Michigan City SWAT team members surrounded a rundown Lakeshore Drive home for nearly 3 hours Thursday morning after an elderly man answered a LaPorte County Health Department search warrant with a loaded shotgun. SWAT team stormed the home of Robert J. Smith, 76, of Lakeshore Drive at 1 p.m. after Smith chased Health Department employees from his property and fired a shotgun toward a group of police officers. He was arrested and charged with criminal recklessness and resisting law enforcement, a Class B felony. Smith was reportedly in LaPorte Hospital this morning on the psychiatric floor. It's not known whether he will be jailed. Health Department employees had obtained the civil warrant to enter Smith's home following numerous complaints from neighbors about health and safety conditions in the Lakeshore Drive home. Larry Davis, an investigator from LaPorte County Adult Protective Services, said 4 years ago his department investigated the Smith home after hearing that Robert Smith had asked a local hospital how he could go about amputating his wife's leg, which was infected with gangrene. Okay. And then, you know, the article goes on, but at the time that they stormed the home, he and his wife were still there. His wife, I don't know what or whether her leg was saved, but it was, you know, still in this condition. So, and this raises a real dilemma for the law, because when you hear of a situation like that, I think the reaction that most people have is, well, of course we should intervene. You know, we shouldn't, no one should be living in that kind of squalor. Think of this poor woman who is bedridden and, you know, the husband is going to do a, you know, an amputation on his own. But with that type of intervention, you know, we're concerned about protection, but we also have to be concerned about autonomy and the rights of adult, you know, competent adult individuals to make their own decisions and have control over how they live their lives. One of the responses to this type of a problem is the formation of what we call adult protective services in a state. I think someone, you know, brought that up before. Almost all states now have some type of law on the book which address elder abuse. Some do not address specifically elder abuse, but more adult protection, but most address elder abuse, and it's defined usually by some type of an age cutoff. So that if someone over the age of 65, let's say it's a commonly used age, is suspected of being abused or neglected or exploited, then under these statutes, there is usually a mandatory reporting provision. So if a person is aware that this is going on, there's a mandatory obligation to report. And then the agency has really two functions. One, to provide services for those in need in the community. And the other, the power to intervene. And, you know, this is where we get into this dilemma of you know, how much power should the state have to intervene into the lives of adults? And, you know, how do we protect what we call the state's interest in ensuring the safety of its citizens without unduly impinging upon, you know, the rights of people to control their own lives? I think it becomes particularly ironic when you think about the fact that as adults, we have the right to refuse any kind of medical treatment that we wish to refuse, even if it's treatment that's necessary to save our lives. If you're competent, you can say, I do not wish this treatment. So under the law, we have that as a right, but now if we have a law that says, but you don't have the right to accept abuse in your life. So if you're in a living situation where you're maybe not getting enough to eat, where you're not, your hygiene needs are not being met adequately, but as an adult you choose not to report that or not to fight it, can the law step in and say, well, you can't do that, you know? You can refuse an operation that would be necessary to save your life, but you can't refuse to live in filth. What do you think about that? And where do the equities lie in this kind of a situation?
Well, I think some of it comes out of epidemiology, that that living in filth can cause diseases and problem vectors for the neighborhood and other people. And so there's a community health issue that says you can't have an open landfill disguised as a home.
Anyone who's seen the photographs that are circulating, that's a pretty good description of what, what's there.
Well, he apparently is mentally incompetent, and his wife, if she's bedridden, I've heard the article yet, and she's the one that's being abused. So somebody should come to her aid, like you'd come to the aid of the child.
Okay, any other thoughts?
But the person reported has to agree to it. I have reported people to Adult Protective Services, and they go out there and the person denies that there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and they have to have a certain amount of, I mean, it has to be pretty bad before Adult Protective Services, at least in our state, will do anything. Even the health department, I had a case where someone was, they didn't even have running water, and it was really bad, and the health department wouldn't do anything. And it, because of the autonomy.
Was this person living on their own, or was someone
living
else?
Living on their own. Okay. Very, very kind, wonderful person, but did not take care of himself. He even donated. He would not hire any help. He donated $20 to the group that I belong to help someone in need. And I couldn't think of anyone who needed that spent more than him.
Mm-hmm.
But he could afford it, but he just didn't think he needed it. And there was nothing we could do to convince him. It was really sad.
There was a case, a neighbor of ours, his mother and father had died, and he was living on his own. He wasn't old, he was in the mid-50s probably. Probably a little bit mentally retarded, I suppose. But he kept dogs, 15 dogs in the house. And you can smell the house as you walk by the house. And somebody finally reported him, and they took him out of the house, and the house had to be torn down. It couldn't be saved. It was just totally decayed inside.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we didn't report it because we felt like we were going to be betraying him.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's I think particularly difficult about, you know, elder abuse and neglect, even if it's self-neglect, is that with child abuse, you know, there's this feeling of, well, the child really can't look out for his or her own best interests. So it's the duty of adult members of society to step in, and the state justifies its authority under the concept of, you know, parens patria, that they have the right, you know, to look out for those that can't look out for themselves. But when we're talking about adults, and especially adults who are mentally competent, they may not be using good judgment, but they're still mentally competent, then on what basis, you know, do we justify going in and intervening? And I think that that's why so many cases of adult abuse are not reported, because there is this feeling that, you know, well, as an adult, you know, is it my right to go in and report on some other adult? The other problem is, you know, why don't the victims complain? You know, let's say especially in a domestic situation.
Well, I think, first of all, out of fear for something even more. And this gal did report it, and the nurse was consequently fired mm-hmm. because of it. But and I think that a lot of them are just afraid that their other staff members or, you know, the member of the family that they reported against will just take it out of their remorse.
Right. There is a fear of retaliation, and I think especially in an institutional situation where, you know, the staff member may not be fired, if the institution may even be aware that this kind of thing is going on, and for, you know, money reasons or just poor conscience on the part of these people that they condone it by allowing it to continue. I think that for people of means, they usually have a choice in that they can go to another institution, but that doesn't apply to most people in an institutionalized setting. For those that are already on Medicaid, they may have been private pay when they entered an institution, but now, let's say it's 3 or 4 years down the line, they're on Medicaid, and to get a bed in another facility is, you know, almost impossible. So it becomes very difficult in that setting. And in the private home setting, I think that many times people do not complain because they fear being institutionalized. What are the options? You know, if they're only being fed once a day, if their Social Security checks are being used for their relatives' expenses rather than theirs, if they complain about it, what's their option? Go to an institution. They may not be able to live on their own, and so they're quiet. They say nothing about it. And even for Adult Protective Services, you know, we talk about, well, these terrible situations should be handled, but then if they're not properly funded to provide good alternatives for people, then you save people, but you save them for what? You know, where will they go once they're taken out of their own homes?
Can I say something?
Sure.
That's a good point because, you know, no matter how bad a situation is, I think most people are happier and better off in their own places. I see a lot of people in their homes, and usually they're very nervous at first. And if things aren't perfect, the first thing they're worried about is, I'm going to recommend they go to a nursing home. And the minute I tell them, hey, my job is to help you stay in your home if that's what you want, they just kind of relax, and we work together on things to help them mm-hmm. stay there. And
Do you work for a social welfare agency?
I'm a home care.
So you have a lot of experience with this. Yeah, it's it really creates a dilemma, I think, on an individual level and on a societal level as we try to find creative ways to deal with what's going to be an increasing issue for us. Of the, you know, the statistics that show that we're becoming an older society, it's the age group 85 and older that are the fastest growing segment of that. So as you know, we talked yesterday, we can't categorize what people's needs are by their chronological age. It's not fair or even accurate to make those kind of assessments on an age-based determination. You know, there are some people that no matter how old they live, they will never lose mental capacity. They'll be fortunate to have their capabilities, and they may only suffer diminished physical capacities. But it is a fact that the likelihood that people will have greater needs increases as we hit the years of a very advanced age. So, you know, these are going to be problems we're going to see with increasing frequency. So given that it is such a difficult dilemma, you know, what can we do besides say, gee, this is a terrible thing, and somebody ought to do something about it? Do you have any programs in your own communities that you see that are?
You know, adult protection is sort of all over, has a reputation for, or a notorious reputation for being effective. It's partly because of the nature of the tasks they've been given, of course. And they're dealing with these people somewhat, you know, it's unavoidable. It gets to be somewhat confrontational. And some of these people have early Alzheimer's, and paranoia is a big symptom of that anyway, so it complicates things. And one, I just know one of the things that's more effective in those sort of situations over time is, like at St. Paul, so we have this Black Nurse Program that you get some of these problematic cases that are reported to them. And they're nurses that are public health nurses, they're actually living in the neighborhoods of these people. And sometimes you're just a couple blocks away or something. And it doesn't happen right away. But sometimes it's just building up over time, a sort of trust level that develops that usually makes interventions effective, or makes transitions effective if they have to take place.
Or it may prevent the need for those.
Right,
if
yeah.
They can get
it
some
does
help.
Do that, but mm-hmm. You do get some of those cases where you think that, well, this would be an automatic nursing home, and just take a while to work with them, and things stabilize for a while, and maybe it's down the road a ways that they actually mm-hmm. have to make a transition. But it's something that's more neighborly, less confrontational, and seems to work fairly well. And when you lack that type of thing, it takes a lot in neighborhoods to substitute for that, because people have to express a level of concern to and get to know their neighbors well, and that sort of thing.
That's right. It takes a lot of time and effort that most of us perceive we don't have to spend in that way. And one thing that I'd like to bring out in a little more clear way than I did earlier on this situation of intervention, and that is that intervention by Adult Protective Services, it may be voluntary and it may be involuntary. Voluntary, where the person consents to the intervention and consents to the help. And under the law, if a person is mentally competent, then technically that type of consent is required. And as comment was made earlier, that there was an individual whose situation was really pretty desperate, but the person would not consent to intervention. However, many state statutes are not worded very clearly or specifically. And so the statute may just say if the person lacks capacity, then the state may come in and intervene. Well, how are we going to define what lacking capacity is? And what's even worse, I think, is that there are statutes that will define lack of capacity as one of the causes of lack of capacity is advanced age. Another example of ageism. How can we say that just because someone is of advanced age that we can use that as a basis for saying that they lack capacity? But it happens. And there's been reform in many states where groups have been active enough to say that this is not right and there needs to be more due process for the respect of the individual. And so it's always this delicate balance of protection on the one hand, autonomy on the other, and deciding, what happens. What happens in an involuntary intervention is usually something like this. A guardianship will be appointed. And we'll be talking more on Thursday, I believe it is, about living wills and durable powers of attorney. And one of the greatest benefits for anyone of any age of a durable power of attorney is avoiding the necessity of guardianship. With guardianship, your rights are basically terminated as a competent individual, and the person that is appointed guardian for you is then in the position to make all of the decisions. There's two types of guardianship, basically. One that's over the person, which would mean your decisions regarding residence, health care. The other type of guardianship is guardianship over your estate or your property, and so that would mean all of your financial decisions. Usually when a guardianship is instituted for an incompetent person, it's over both, over their person and their property. And while limited guardianship is usually available and is being advocated by reformists, meaning that you would institute a guardianship only to the extent and scope of the area where the person needs the assistance, because for so long the law has
dealt with these complete guardianships in an, especially in an official intervention kind of a situation, that's what happens. Chances of having that terminated, if the person regains competency, I mean, let's say that they're suffering from a temporary kind of dementia. You know, they have an illness, or they should have been on medication for high blood pressure, or, you know, there's been something that has caused them to not be thinking as clearly as they would have otherwise. They get the treatment, and now they could be competent to maybe live in their home or handle their own affairs, and now there's a guardian appointed. And so their checkbook is out of their hands, maybe their property's already been sold, and now they're institutionalized, and the likelihood of being able to reverse that process and having the funds to do it, it is quite remote. And so, yes?
Does the state have the right of intervention for anybody who is determined to be incompetent, or what I'm trying to say is, who would an alcoholic, for instance, be incompetent if he's damaging his health?
If someone would petition the court to have a guardianship appointed over that person, and that person were brought into court, given their due notice under the law, examined by a doctor, and testimony was made, and a judge determined that that person was incompetent, yes, that person can be subjected to a guardianship, just as, you know, any person of advanced age, or, you know, physical or mental handicap, you know, who's determined not to be competent. So guardianship has really nothing to do, I mean, it's not an age-related process under the law. It's just that it's often used in situations of advanced age where the person can't handle their property.
But you can imagine that if a person was, say, an alcoholic, and somebody turned him in, mm-hmm. became a guardian, and then the guy recovered, this person would be
penalized. Yeah. That's why in speaking to community groups, I encourage people to really look at their own situations, their family relationships, and again, you know, I have to say this is totally age unrelated, and say, if you were not able to handle your personal and business affairs for whatever reason, even for a temporary period of time, is there someone in your life that you trust that you would choose to have handle these things for you? And through doing a durable power of attorney and appointing a healthcare representative, you can avoid the necessity of a guardianship. And the beauty of those techniques for handling it is that they're easily revoked if a person regains competence. You don't have to lose title to your property, you know. And, you know, again, it requires that there be a relationship of trust, because they are open to abuse, just like guardianships are. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, a guardianship, it's both a means for dealing with physical abuse and neglect. If someone is in a neglected situation, having a guardian appointed may be part of the remedy for that. But a guardianship may also be a source of neglect. In most states, guardians have to report to the court at most once a year, and in some states it's twice a year, and many times the only type of reporting that they have to make is a financial reporting. So there's no report being given to the court on the mental or physical well-being of the ward, only on how the money is being spent. And as a practicing attorney and having compiled these reports for courts, I know that if a guardian chose to funnel money off for their own use, that it would be very easy to do that, so that, you know, not only the attorney wouldn't know, but the court also wouldn't know that this was going on in terms of the way in which they kept receipts and a checkbook.
Is competency determined only by a judge?
In most states, the judge has the ability to do that. There may be some states where a jury would actually get involved in the competency determination, but normally jury involvement is limited to situations where we're talking about money damages. And so for what are more equitable kinds of remedies, as the guardianship proceeding would be, it's usually up to the discretion of the judge. And so the judge will listen to the testimony. There are usually requirements that they get doctor's reports. But, you know, I'll be frank, the requirements are not that that onerous in most states. It's just been recently in the state that I'm from, in Indiana, that they've tightened the requirement about the person over whom the guardianship will be instituted being present for the hearing if it won't physically endanger their health. It used to be that, you know, anytime a doctor would sign that, you know, the person really didn't need to be there, that the court would not require that. And even that's a double-edged sword, because yes, it protects the person, but on the other hand, it also is demeaning. I mean, I was in a situation where I had to drive to the next state and take an 85-year-old woman from a nursing home who was suffering from advanced Alzheimer's, but physically was fine, and drive her back to Indiana to have her sit there and be asked questions by a judge and have her give answers that, of course, had no correlation whatsoever. And this was a woman who had run her own business, had been, you know, a very active, productive member of society, and it was incredibly sad. I mean, to watch this and to see her be subjected to that is a, you know, tough thing.
Maybe this isn't in your expertise, but it seems to me that a generation ago, kids took care of their parents when they got older, and that must have been true previous to that forever. And it occurs, and maybe I have a misunderstanding, but my parents took care of their parents when they could no longer take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a societal norm that no longer exists in our culture. And that goes two ways. It appears to me that my parents, who are now 70, in their mid-70s, don't want to be a burden to their kids, and so they don't want to form a relationship with them that says you'll take care of me, won't you, when I'm mm-hmm. 84, 64, whatever the date is. Is that true, or has there been a neglect of the parents all through history?
I think there is some truth to that, but only some, for several reasons. One is that the amount of time during which an elderly parent or grandparent might be dependent upon a family was far shorter in earlier times, because people didn't live as long. So in terms of what it meant to take care of the elderly in a society, it wasn't, you know, the 20, 30 years that it might be in our society, because our lives are so much longer. So I think that people did take care of elderly, but it wasn't the same need as we have today. The other is, I think it's probably more, I've read a study, someone that's done a paper on that subject in particular, that said that really, in terms of that being true as a general societal norm, that probably was only true through about the medieval ages, and after that it became less and less true. The other extreme, in fact, I have a clip to show on Saturday, because Saturday we'll be talking about responsibility and how that has changed through the times, is that in many societies, the elderly were not taken care of. At a time at which a person could no longer take care of themselves, they were left on an ice drift, you know, for example, as the Eskimo customs in Norway, you know, to put a person on a boat and sail them out to sea with, you know, some provisions, this kind of thing, and looking as, you know, the natural cycle of life, that when you can no longer take care of yourself, then those resources are resources that should be used for the young. So it's really not something that's been a matter of you know, societal ethic for all times, that the elderly, you know, have been taken care of in that way. The other thing that I think has certainly made it different is that we're such a mobile society now. We don't live in close communities where people are born and live and work and die in the same community. And so that has also affected the ability of people to take care of their own, and a heavier reliance on, you know, institutional alternatives.
Yes. I came in a few minutes late, so I don't know whether this is something that you covered, but you were talking about a durable power of attorney. Can you explain a little bit what that is?
Sure. A durable power of attorney, it used to be that when you gave someone your power of attorney, that person could do anything that you could do, basically, on your own behalf, but no more than what you could do. So in other words, if while I'm competent, I give someone a power of attorney, they can go out and do business deals for me, sign my names to checks. But historically, if I became incompetent, that person could no longer act for me because I could no longer act for myself. And certainly on death, you know, that this power of attorney was no longer valid. Now with a durable power of attorney, under the law, a change has been made so that we now have the ability to make that power durable, which says that it will continue on in effect even if I'm no longer mentally competent to act for myself. As in the past, it still terminates on death. But so some people get slightly confused. They think that if they do a durable power of attorney, that there's no need to do a last will and testament or appoint an executor for their estate and that type of thing. It's not a substitute for that. But what it is, it's a hedge against a guardianship type proceeding, because the power of attorney will continue on, you know, past your competency if that's what you so desire. There's also the option that you can do a power of attorney that doesn't become effective until you are incompetent. So there are people that are concerned about giving away control over their property in the present when they're still able to make decisions, and they may be more comfortable about having it become effective only upon incompetency, and in most states you can do that as well. Also, in many states you can do a power of attorney of this type, not only for your property but for your health care, so that you could do a durable power of attorney that includes both property powers and health care powers. Because even if you've taken care of your property, someone asked me yesterday about living trusts, and we'll talk a little more about those on Thursday as well. Some people think that they're all set if they have a living trust, but even if you had everything in a living trust, if you became incompetent and couldn't make your health care decisions and maybe had to be institutionalized, a guardian would have to be appointed, because a nursing home, retirement home, whatever, would not accept you for admittance if there was not a person with authority to sign papers and make those decisions for you.
What about a living will along those things?
Okay. A living will serves an important function, but a limited function. A living will is based on the recognition, it's kind of an extension of this idea that competent people can choose to refuse any kind of medical treatment that someone may want to give them. A living will says, if I'm incompetent, this is what I want done. And most states have statutory forms that kind of limit what you can and cannot do in that living will form. But generally, they revolve around the idea that if you're in a life, you have a terminal illness or injury, and death is imminent, that you can choose not to have life-prolonging procedures. Whether or not those procedures would include artificial food and hydration, like tube feedings, differs from state to state. But there's been a Supreme Court case, the Cruzan case, where the Supreme Court, even though that wasn't the matter they were deciding in the case, they said, for purposes of discussing this case, we're going to assume that artificial food and hydration is a medical treatment, and it's something that you could choose, you know, to refuse if you were competent to do so, or, you know, in the case of a living will, could choose to include as those treatments that, you know, shouldn't be given. So that's really as far as a living will goes. And while those should be respected, depending on where you might be at the time, what I recommend to people is that they appoint a healthcare representative. So that you have someone, you not only have it on a piece of paper, but you've got a person there who will be an advocate for you so that your wishes are followed.
So that if you would become, I mean, like I have a living will right now, but if you had court-appointed a guardian, could that court-appointed guardian supersede that living will if they chose to?
Okay, that's a good question. A court-appointed guardian, while they are given some powers to make decisions over your person, unless you're in a state where by state statute that person is given the power to make health care decisions and have those decisions include like the withdrawal of life support and that sort of thing, their authority may not extend that far. And at least in the states that I'm familiar with, if you've appointed a health care representative, even if a guardian would subsequently be appointed, usually as to the matters of health care, if it was a valid appointment of a health care representative, that person would trump anyone else. And that's true even when it comes to family members. If you appoint a health care representative and your spouse or adult children, you know, think one thing should be done, but the health care representative says something else, under the law, they are supposed to follow the direction of the health care representative. So it's really pretty, it's a pretty powerful tool that we have available to make sure that, you know, what we would like to see happen would happen in, you know, unfortunate circumstances.
What about in circumstances where, you know, your family members disagree, you know, as to what the treatment should be? I think that happens frequently.
Well, that does. And I think that where you see those kind of, if there hasn't been a clear-cut healthcare representative appointed, then I think it's usually a matter that is somehow resolved between the family and the medical personnel, the healthcare givers on the scene. And I guess really the only thing I can respond to that from a legal standpoint would be that's one of the reasons for appointing a healthcare representative, so that there is somebody that in the final analysis has the power to say this is the way it's going to be if there's disagreements. So in the time that we have left, I'd like to just mention a few other ways in which the law presently responds to this situation of elder abuse and neglect, and some ways in which we can maybe be helpful to people in our communities that are in need so that they avoid being in a position where they can be exploited or abused. The durable power of attorney, we've done a pretty good job of talking about that. Other options would be if you know someone that doesn't have a close family member or friend that they can depend upon, but let's say they have some significant assets. A trust may be appropriate for them with an institutional trustee like a bank or investment company. Maybe a way to go. There would still be the need of having someone that they could appoint as a healthcare representative, but oftentimes in our lives we have people that we would trust to make the personal decisions for us, but they may not have the expertise to handle our business affairs. And so as far as advising a person who may live alone, you may advise them to think about identifying someone that they could trust with their business, someone that they could trust with their personal needs. Also, if there's a problem with, you suspect that maybe somebody's Social Security check is being diverted from their use, maybe endorsed by, you know, a grandchild or somebody that may be living with them. Social Security checks, like any other kind of payments, can be direct deposited so that you avoid the problem of somebody snatching a check out of the mail and using it. You can also set up something with the Social Security Administration, which is called a representative payee. So instead of having the Social Security check sent to the person directly or even direct deposited, you can have it sent to their payee. Again, all of these things can be cures as well as sources of problems because they're, you know, open for the possibility of abuse. But, you know, let's say you have a person that really doesn't want to give somebody a power of attorney, but they've got this problem of how they manage their money, and you know, that's a possible option as well. I think the other thing that in the broader picture that we need to look at is this idea of reform and placing higher expectations on guardians, you know, encouraging state legislatures to look at requiring court visitors. You know, if you have a guardian that's in place and they're not taking care of the person, and let's say they're exploiting the funds, filing the financial report may turn some of that up, but But what about having some just direct observation of how this person is doing, the ward of the guardianship, and having even volunteers? You know, this is a problem. Every time we talk about reform, it means money. And many of the problems that we presently have are because we have inadequate funding, so it becomes a vicious circle. But one of the programs that is in place now under the Older Americans Act is called the State Ombudsman's Program. And under this act, if states receive federal funding, which all of them do for these area agencies on aging, they are required to have an ombudsman, that a person, whether they be in institutional care or in a domestic setting, can write to this person for assistance. However, they don't have enough people to staff these programs. Most states have somewhere between 1 and 3 full-time people that work in the program. And when you consider the task of monitoring, you know, institutions and complaints from people in institutions for an entire state, that's not enough. And so while it's not something that's widely publicized, you know, these are organizations that would welcome people who would agree to be volunteer visitors and to go out into nursing homes and see how people are doing. Because when you think about it, if someone's institutionalized and they have a complaint, how many people out there do you think are even aware that there's an ombudsman that they can write and complain to? You know, it's one thing to have a remedy, it's another to have access to that remedy. And I think that is a big problem as well. So I think that there are some ways that, even though it seems like a big problem, that on an individual level, by, you know, looking out in our own neighborhoods for people that might be in need, and maybe even making a more formal commitment to do some volunteering in our communities, maybe we can make a difference. Okay. I think we're about at time. Any other questions or things you'd like to talk about?
In response to what somebody said about whether families help as much, I think families really are still, for the most part, committed, and they do help. But I think there's two things that make it harder. And one is, so many of the people in the age they would be helping their parents are also working full-time and having their families.
You know, that's an excellent point, and one that I didn't really talk much about this morning. But, you know, one of the causes of elder abuse is family stress and financial stress. And, you know, when we hear about abuse, we think, what an awful thing. Who would, you know, treat a 90-year-old person with fragile skin so roughly that her arms would become bruised? Or, you know, who would do this or not do that? But many times the person who's being cared for is not, you know, the sweet profile of a grandmother or grandfather that, you know, that we think of. It may be a person who's suffering from severe dementia, who may be very obstreperous, you know, maybe the equivalent of, in terms of behavior, of a difficult 3-year-old, you know, throwing a tantrum. And with children, we somehow get through the stress as parents because our children grow up and grow out of it. But if you have someone that let's say is suffering from Alzheimer's, it may be 10 years that this person is in that kind of a behavior mode. And the stress of that becomes very difficult for family members to handle. And another program, I'm glad you made that comment, because it sort of slipped past me this morning, are adult daycare centers. You know, this is something we'll talk about more on Friday, but some alternatives so that people can stay in their homes and be cared for, but with the recognition that the caregivers need a respite. They need a break from that and need to be able to attend to their children. They talk about the sandwich generation, you know, people that are kind of still getting their own children launched out into the world, and just at the time when, you know, they ought to be having a little more freedom in their life, now all of a sudden they are caring for very aged parents. And sometimes when the demands from both sides meet, it becomes more stress than what people can handle. And so we need to look at not only the needs of the person in need of care, but the needs of the caregiver as well.
To end it on a happy note, I have my father had 2 families, and I'm his second. I have his second family, but his first family were 5 boys, and my oldest half brother, Elmer Bartley, in Watertown, South Dakota, he and his wife, they celebrated their 70th wedding anniversary. to go to that party and see so many elderly people come, you know, and they're all pretty good. I don't know what it is about the Midwest, but it seems like people survive pretty well there. And Elmer's 90 and Elvina's 94, and they both have been very, you know, active in their lives, but they were helped, I think, by the smaller town and the fact they can go to the senior center every day and they have lots of activities. And they were very involved in Elvina. When we came 5 years ago, she apologized because she didn't have a lemon meringue pie made for us. And this time when we came, she was up to her elbows in dishwater.
Yes.
You know? And it was just one of the most wonderful experiences that I've had lately, was to go to their anniversary party.
And I think that what you're describing, that we can see that with more and more frequency if we become conscious about what the needs are of aging and find non-institutional ways to help people do that. And that's really what I want to concentrate on for Friday. Just for any of you that might be interested in coming to another session, Thursday we'll be talking about living wills, durable powers of attorney, appointment of healthcare representative. Friday, talking about non-institutional alternatives for long-term care and some of the issues there. And on Saturday, really looking at how we define responsibility and how that notion has changed over the years, and maybe in this whole new world that we're looking at this summer in Holden, how we'll have to change our views of what responsibility means. So thanks for coming this morning. It's been a great group.
Thank you.